Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On January 23rd, Saudi Arabia's monarch, King Abdullah, passed away at the age of 90. The late king has been remembered as a modernizing reformer, and the kingdom has been described as an island of stability in a volatile region. Even though Saudi Arabia's long-standing ban on women drivers and the more recent flogging of the Saudi blogger Raif Badawi has shed light on the country's gross human rights violations, the late king's support of the dictatorship in Yemen and crushing the pro-democracy forces in Bahrain have been largely overlooked by Western media and pundits alike. President Obama cut short his trip to India to pay his respects to the late king and to meet newly crowned King Salman. The president said the U.S. needs to balance its concerns about Saudi human rights with immediate concerns like counterterrorism and regional stability. 27 U.S. current and former government officials, including Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, Senator John McCain, and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, also flew to Saudi Arabia. Current Secretary of State John Kerry called King Abdullah a man of wisdom and vision. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about Saudi Arabia. How can we go beyond the official narrative in order to better understand Saudi Arabia's ruling class, the country's sphere of regional influence, and its relations with the United States? Joining us today is Toby Jones, Associate Professor of Middle East History at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Hi, Toby. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sheila Carapico is Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond and author of Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. Hi, Sheila. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
It's great to have you. So first off, Sheila, I'd love to get your thoughts on this big delegation that dropped everything to fly to Saudi Arabia, 27 current and former government officials. Like I said, Secretary of State John Kerry called King Abdullah a man of wisdom and vision. President Obama is being widely criticized because when he was in India, he encouraged women and religious minorities to be protected in Indian society and didn't say anything about the gross human rights violations in Saudi Arabia. So first off, how do you explain this glowing eulogy?
Well, I mean, excuse me. Oh, my goodness. Excuse me. I mean, it's an embarrassment, right, to have that many high-ranking American officials go to Saudi Arabia at all. I mean, the occasion of the death of the king is one thing, but Obama and a number of other American top administration officials have visited also in the past year. So it's clear that maintaining a very close working relationship with the kingdom and the royal family is very high priority for Obama, as it has been for all of his predecessors for decades. And I don't think we can boil that down purely to oil. I think that, you know, it's also important to American interests that Saudi Arabia continue to purchase a lot of weapons and to kind of justify the massive American military presence in the Persian Gulf.
And Toby, it wasn't just U.S. representatives who took part in this glowing eulogy. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon described the king as a, quote, wise and compassionate leader. What are your thoughts on what we've been hearing in light of this death?
Well, as Sheila remarked, I mean, it is remarkable the extent to which these sorts of platitudes have been rolling in. You know, we do need to be mindful that these are not historically exceptional. It's long been the case that Saudi Arabia has been lauded by American, Western, and even other leaders as having this kind of remarkable presence and important role in maintaining whatever we mean by stability in the Middle East. I mean, I think what's so interesting about all of this is that much of this is offered in spite of the evidence to the contrary, in spite of the evidence that Abdullah was just as crude and tyrannical as his predecessors, in spite of the evidence that Saudi Arabia is complicit in the rise of kind of regional terrorism, global jihadism. And in spite of the evidence that Saudi Arabia has an interest in promoting an anti-democratic political order across the region, all of those things directly at odds with our interests, the way we talk about our interests and our quote-unquote values. I mean, so Sheila's right, you can't boil this down to a particularly simple explanation, but even being unable to do so, it is astounding what's gone on.
And Sheila, you said this is not purely about oil. Talk a little bit more about that, because Saudi Arabia is the United States' longest-standing strategic partner in the Middle East. So why is Saudi Arabia so important to the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, part of it is energy and reliance on Saudi Arabia, not so much as a supplier, but historically, although it's not working right now, as a swing producer to help to stabilize the price of oil. But in addition, I think like almost everything else in American policy, so much else in American policy in the larger Middle East region, a lot of it is a legacy of the Cold War that, you know, doesn't make sense anymore. So, I mean, the American relationship with Saudi Arabia was cemented in the aftermath of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, which, of course, was also the year of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And then it was the American-Saudi partnership in support of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, I think, that deepened and strengthened the relationship. And it doesn't seem as though anyone has stepped back in the decades in the meantime to ask whether that relationship is still viable. And then, you know, then the Iraq wars also, although not necessarily enthusiastic, the second one, 2003, not necessarily enthusiastically supported by the Saudi kingdom, and yet part of the rationale seemed to be, as it had been in the first American war in Iraq in 1991, rationale seems to be protecting Saudi Arabia. And then one last point on that, I think also our drone operations in Yemen, the rationale is protecting the Saudi kingdom.
And Toby, what are your thoughts on this? How do you explain the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S.? Why is Saudi Arabia so important to the U.S.?
Well, I think I agree that this is rooted in you know, historically, the United States, first in the form of corporate interests acting in the Middle East in the pursuit of oil in the 1930s, and then ever since, we've seen rising diplomatic and political ties that have grown increasingly deep and close. You know, the conventional way of thinking about this is that the Saudis provide oil, they stabilize global oil markets, they make sure that the price doesn't rise too high, and of course this ebbs and flows. I mean, there are inconsistencies in all of this over time in exchange for American security assurances, and that is kind of the basic bargain that we're often told captures the nature of the relationship. I have a slightly more complicated take. It doesn't lend itself to easy analysis, but I think that over time, that in fact, this isn't a normal relationship. It's more like an entanglement where American interests begin or end overlaps not just in political ways or geopolitical ways with Saudi Arabia, but in economic and material ways as well. I mean, they are essentially in lockstep with one another, and they're entangled with one another in ways that cannot easily be separated. And I think that helps explain why so many people you know, bow to them in such meaningful and embarrassing ways.
Hmm. Sheila, can you, how should we understand the relationship historically and also in the aftermath of the quote, war on terror?
Well, you know, I mean, again, as Toby so rightly says, these things are very complicated, and
well, we've got time, so we don't have sound bites, which is good.
No, okay, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, of course, it's obvious that either the Saudi kingdom or individuals within the royal family played a very important role in fostering the movement that now is al-Qaeda and the jihadist movements in their various guises. And that, of course, again, comes from Afghanistan at a time when, and my students are just astounded to even consider this possibility, but at the time it was considered that, you know, Muslims were kind of inherently passive and also maybe even pacifistic. So we didn't consider the possibility that in fomenting a jihad, we would also be fomenting a movement that would come back to bite the Saudis as well as the United States. And then I think the American reactions, you know, including the term global war on terrorism, have become sort of self-fulfilling in the sense that they increase what Toby just called an entanglement with the kingdom, that then also, I don't know, I mean, somehow we don't, or this administration in particular has not brought in voices, scholars, or other kinds of experts who might provide some valuable perspective on this. Instead, it's become just sort of self-perpetuating, I think.
Have you seen any changes under the Obama administration?
No, I definitely haven't. I mean, for me, one of the most annoying moments was last year, was it March, Toby, when he visited and he was praising, you know, basically an organization that protects women and children, one category. I mean, so they just reach for just any excuse to praise even things which are clearly despicable. And we haven't even mentioned, you know, the executions by crucifixion and beheading. But no, I don't see a change in policy over time, certainly not between Democrats and Republicans, as evidenced by the turnout for the funeral of the late king.
Right. And again, 27 U.S. current and former government officials, including Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, Senator John McCain, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and current Secretary of State John Kerry, went to Saudi Arabia to meet the new king. And also John Kerry called the former king, Abdullah, a man of wisdom and vision. Today we are talking about Saudi Arabia. And it's so interesting. What questions do you have about Saudi Arabia? I mean, this is a massive topic. But when you look at the Western media and even activists, they focus on the ban on women driving, the recent flogging of the Saudi blogger Raif Badawi. They look at gross human rights violations, beheadings, as they should, but a lot of things tend to get missed. The crushing of the Arab Spring, the late king's support of the dictatorship in Yemen, crushing pro-democracy forces in Bahrain. So what questions do you have about Saudi Arabia? What's really struck you about what you've read in the news since the death of King Abdullah and also President Obama being called out for mentioning human rights and women's rights in India and being totally silent in Saudi Arabia? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and author of Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice, and Representation. Toby Jones is an associate professor of Middle East History at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Toby, let's step back a little bit and talk about how decisions are made in Saudi Arabia. And just, I mean, I looked at photos of the kings and who will come next once King Abdullah died. For example, what happens next after the new king. So can you just talk about that? How are decisions made in Saudi Arabia?
Well, of course, the king sits atop the political order, right? I mean, this is, we need to think about this in relatively modern terms, that Saudi Arabia is not some throwback to some sort of medieval moment in the 7th or 8th century. The Saudis have not sought to recreate the era of the Prophet of Islam or anything like that. They've carved out and built in the 20th century what by any measure is a modern state. I mean, it's a bureaucratic order. It's very boring and mundane in how it operates. There are lots of ministries and modern bureaucratic offices, and we'd probably be just as angered by having to navigate those as we are the ones here at home. I mean, I live in the state of New Jersey. It's probably just as corrupt as Saudi Arabia in important ways. And it's relatively new. It was founded in 1932, and that followed about three decades of war and territorial expansion. The Al Saud come out of Central Arabia and expanded first toward the Persian Gulf and then later toward the Red Sea and consolidated control in the 19-teens and 1920s. The way power operates, to the extent that we can know it at all, I mean, this is a black box in some ways. None of us have access to the inner workings of power. We only know what we're told. And oftentimes people who tell stories about how decisions get made have an interest in one particular narrative getting out there. But what we do know is that the family has been embattled over time, and it's been embattled by internal forces, and it's even suffered from internal rifts, rivalries and challenges from amongst senior princes and senior figures within the family. And over time, what the Elsaud have learned is that collectively their primary interest is in maintaining their own stability. So they have a king who is certainly the most important and most visible figure in the family, but most likely rules as the first amongst equals. He has to negotiate a big family with extensive and complicated ways of thinking, and I'm sure that all major policy decisions about how the state operates, what Saudi Arabia's foreign interests are probably negotiated to some extent amongst those senior figures. When it comes to domestic issues, the most important princes are given responsibility over various fiefdoms, if you will, and they basically administer their own interests. So, for example, the current deputy prime minister, who is third in line to be king after Salman passes and then Salman's younger brother dies, he'll be the first grandson of the original founder to take over the top spot. He's currently the Minister of the Interior, and that means he controls the intelligence and police services, which gives him a tremendous amount of power, but it's also power that's distinctive from an uncle who controls the defense ministry or others in other positions of influence. So the kingdom is weird, right? I mean, it's a family that's got its own interests that are the priority, and preserving and stabilizing and protecting those interests are above everything else. And then they've carved out their own little small fiefdoms or sinecures within that order. So in some level, it's bifurcated and complicated and distributed. At others, it's consolidated, especially at the top.
Sheila, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I would elaborate on the other side, which you hinted at, which is the kind of panic in Riyadh and the rest of the kingdom about what the Arab uprisings in 2011. Mm-hmm. I mean, crushing the Bahrain uprising, working with the Egyptian military to overthrow the elected Muslim Brotherhood president, and then participating in Yemen in this kind of ridiculous facade of a transition that, you know, left Ali Abdullah Saleh, the deposed president, in charge of the party, which remains the majority party in parliament, and electing his hand-picked vice president as successor. And in all ways, particularly in Yemen, but I think throughout the region, efforts to make sure that youth movements or progressive movements or democratic movements are not successful. And so I'm of the school that sees Saudi Arabia as a deeply reactionary force, modern. I agree certainly with Toby on that. And indeed, you know, in terms of things like construction and lifestyle and material things, they're very modern, but at the same time also very reactionary in terms of tolerance for a democratic process anywhere in the region.
Well, we have a number of calls on the line today. We're talking about Saudi Arabia, the future of Saudi Arabia, and U.S.-Saudi relations. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I'm struck by the difference in the perspectives of the two guests. The gentleman points out, uses words like corporations, personal family, financial interests on the Saudi family, royal family, etc. Whereas the female guest, the lady guest, I'm sorry, I don't know her name.
Sheila
seems to discuss, well, we're sort of stumbling along here. It's something left over from some previous thing with something or other. And then she says, the policy of the United States government is embarrassing. That's the word she used. It's an embarrassment. Now, I'd like to know who she thinks is actually embarrassed by it. Is it the armaments manufacturers who sell the armaments to Saudi Arabia? Who are these people who are embarrassed? I'm not embarrassed because I don't have anything to do with it. Is she embarrassed? Embarrassment is something that a person feels. It's not something that somebody can imagine that somebody else feels. So I'd appreciate her perspective on what she means by embarrassing.
Well, what I mean by embarrassing, I mean, maybe it is that I personally am embarrassed, and that's because I'm an American academic who has spent more than 10 years in the Arab region and also researched American democracy promotion or rhetoric about democracy promotion. And I find that throughout almost every community in the Arab Middle East, there's a profound sense of American hypocrisy. And it's, as an American citizen, sometimes difficult to distance oneself from that sort of thing. I personally also did support the president in his first candidacy in particular, in the expectation that he did have a kind of lawyerly sense of what constitutes human rights. And so that embarrasses me as well. I mean, you're right, of course, that the arms manufacturers are not embarrassed. But as an American citizen, I am.
Can I say something?
Oh, William, go ahead.
Just one thing. I gather then that you identify yourself somehow as being responsible for United States government policy. Maybe that's where we disagree, maybe that's where we differ. I feel no need to identify myself with policies that I oppose and which I've done whatever I can that is within my power to have them not take place. But I could see where other people might feel differently.
Well, let me just briefly comment on that, because actually I think it is my experience living in the Arab world that gives me a slightly different perspective. I certainly try hard to, for example, oppose military actions and don't succeed. But it's really my experience as an American in the Middle East that makes me feel that others somehow hold me at least partly responsible.
Hmm. What do you, in the talks you have with people in the Middle East, when you have these conversations, give us some insight. What are people talking about?
Well, I mean, people frequently mock, and this is a shame, but it's not unusual, but American references to human rights or the rule of law or democratization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, praise for the Saudi monarchy, which abuses human rights and is the very antithesis of democracy, are one example of why people are so cynical and skeptical about the way we talk about these things.
Toby, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that the hypocrisy gets enough attention in the U.S. media?
Well, no, it doesn't, and I think that I'm in many ways she was preaching to the choir with me on the other line. We talk about this quite a bit. We think about this together quite a bit. But if embarrassment is, and let me just address this question. If embarrassment is not the right word, that's fine, right? If listeners or if others who think about American foreign policy and think about our impact and role in the region don't support it, and so therefore don't feel embarrassment by it. There are other adjectives that call to mind that come to mind that we might be able to use: outrage, deeply disturbed, that perhaps should shape the way we act in the world. And I think that it's one thing to disengage or to claim that we're not represented by what the White House or by what our senators or congresspeople do, claiming to speak for us. It's another thing to change the way we behave in the world, consuming oil, driving cars, whatever it is that we do that provides the Saudis, maybe not on an individual level, but collectively, the kind of buffer zone and the reason for our policy to remain the same is something that we should think through. I mean, the consequences of all, what does it mean to be outraged by American policy in Saudi Arabia, whether it's anti-democratic, anti-human rights, or destabilizing in other ways? What would have to change if you were outraged enough?
And Toby, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Thanks for calling in, William. Today, we are talking about Saudi Arabia. King Abdullah recently passed away. Now the new king is King Salman. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways for you to join in today's conversation. You can send an email, question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or join us live on the telephone on the air. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say, and at noon today, John Perry and Ken Taylor and Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our series on police, community, race, and justice with a debate about body cameras. Proponents say body cameras reduce excessive force, ensure accountability, and provide crucial evidence in the courtroom. Opponents say cameras do not tell the whole story, might reveal sensitive information, and are a major invasion of privacy. So where do you stand on body cameras? And then coming up on Thursday, we'll have a conversation about the new documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry. It's a film about the birth of the women's liberation movement in the 1960s. The film opens in theaters on Friday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about Saudi Arabia. If you have any questions or comments, what are your thoughts on the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia? And what questions do you have about Saudi Arabia's role in Yemen and the wider Middle East? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Toby Jones is Associate Professor of Middle East History at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Sheila Carapico is Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond and author of Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. And let's go next to Kevin in Felton. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Years ago, one of the stories being told about Saudi Arabia was the deal that had been cut between the Saudi family and the Orthodox Islamist religious entities in the country who found the royal family to be distasteful in some ways. And this resulted, it was my understanding, in funding coming out of the Saudi family that funded the religious schools that I think it's the Wahhabis operate throughout the world, and my understanding was they were very conservative religious schools, not necessarily attached to terrorism or anything, but nevertheless quite influential. And I wondered, and I knew this got tangled up after the attack on the Trade Center and the fact that there were terrorist attacks inside Saudi Arabia conducted by Al-Qaeda, but is this system still in place? In other words, where the Saudi government takes what are essentially national funds and funnels them into religious education globally, essentially.
All right. Thank you. Toby, do you want to take that one?
Well, the short answer is yes. I appreciate the caller, the question's complexity on various fronts. But the short answer is yes. The Saudi state still concedes ground and cultivates a relationship with adherents of a particularly austere interpretation of Islam, and they rely upon it for, well, we might want to call it legitimacy or credibility, and we can talk about that at length, about what work it does. But there's also something that's even more, there's another layer of complexity. Who do we mean in the Saudi state? I mean, not everybody in Saudi Arabia's government is particularly pious or religious. I mean, this is a manufactured bargain that's meant to accomplish a fairly narrow range of political objectives, and in some ways it's spun out of control. Those who interpret it in the worst possible ways and have spread it into Central Asia or into Iraq and have turned it toward the interests or the practice of terrorism have done so often at odds with what the Saudi royal family initially intended for it to do. So I appreciate the question's complexity in not saying that this thing, Wahhabism, operates according to a function that's all its own. It's always caught up in politics and the interests of individuals and networks who want to get different things out of it. But yes, the Saudis still embrace it. Some of them still provide it with a lot of support and funding and seek to spread it globally.
Sheila, do you have anything to add to that?
Briefly, I mean, I agree with Toby. The short answer is yes. Saudi Arabia is also, you know, a fairly major provider of different kinds, actually, of financial assistance. And so, you know, to some extent, they would say, well, you know, we're helping provide education worldwide, and particularly in Muslim countries. And then secondly, to underscore what Toby just said, is that you can't, at least I can't, always, frequently it doesn't look to me as if there's one unitary actor, the Saudi kingdom, pursuing a single-minded policy. Indeed, that's true of very few countries anyway. And so there are probably variables in terms of who's in charge of what areas of the world and what kind of missions. All of that said, though, I think that, you know, the fundamental premise that they support Muslim education of a very particular kind, which is often, frankly, at odds with practices in, say, Indonesia or Nigeria or lots of other places. This, I think, is quite clear and also very political.
All right. Well, thank you again for the question. Let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes, good morning. I'm not sure why your guest would be surprised the way Obama acted, given that his policy that he stated before when he was running for election regarding Afghanistan. And I was wondering, in an ideal world, how would she see policy towards from the American administration towards Saudi Arabia proceeding? And also, what about Bahrain? That's also another example of egregious deprivation of human rights there, and the U.S. fleet is stationed there. So it's another example of hypocrisy.
All right, thank you. Toby?
Yeah, I don't know that I said I was surprised by consistency in policymaking. I said disappointed, disturbed, outraged. As long as we're clear on that, I mean, you know, we can be disappointed and unsurprised at the same time. There was the promise of something. There's also something else. As we peel back the layers of American policymaking, who does what and who thinks what. It's also not as though there aren't options available to the U.S. to pursue, even if alternatives, even if we cling to the claim, which I'm skeptical about, that we need to be in the Persian Gulf because of oil and energy. There are lots of other ways to think about this, and there are a lot of people in the State Department as well as in the White House who I've talked to who happen to agree, who think that we don't need to maintain this kind of consistent policy with Saudi Arabia, that we don't need to look away when the Bahrainis crack down on their own people or when the Saudi National Guard occupies the country. So the question then becomes, if there's so much opposition within the Beltway and within the D.C. policymaking establishment, why does it remain, for the most part, unchanged? And what are the forces that end up driving all of this forward? Why doesn't Obama shift our direction and alter this hypocritical approach? And I'll give you a clue, at least where I think the center of power on Saudi Arabia and the Gulf and policymaking comes from. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, recently issued an essay competition for students, calling for students to write an essay that would evaluate most wonderfully King Abdullah's legacy. I mean, who could say the most wonderful things about Saudi Arabia? But why would the Department of Defense offer up such a competition and participate in it publicly? I mean, that's embarrassing. But it also signals something about where the center of gravity is on why the Gulf and why Saudi Arabia and why Bahrain play the role that they play and are seen the way that they're seen.
And talk a little bit about Yemen. We just briefly touched on that. But Yemen, a country that's been in Saudi Arabia's sphere of influence, is experiencing a major political meltdown. And I just got a Facebook post saying that some of the Yemenis who live in Oakland are very, very frightened for their families who still live in Yemen. The same day that King Abdullah died, Yemen's president and his entire cabinet resigned after Houthi rebels took over the presidential palace. So, Toby, how much power does Saudi Arabia have in Yemen?
Well, we often overstate the extent of Saudi Arabia's reach in the world, much like we overstate the United States' power in the world. I mean, there are clear limits here. I mean, Sheila knows much more about Yemen and should be in a position to comment on it more than me, but I'll say this. The Saudis tried to orchestrate the transition to power that brought Hadi into the presidency following 2011. The fact that he couldn't remain in a position of prominence and has frankly been embattled by all kinds of internal forces over the last 4 or 5 years suggests precisely the nature of the limits of anyone's authority to act outside of Yemen and to shape it in the way that they'd like.
Sheila?
Yeah, I mean, what's going on in Yemen right now, I mean, it is an implosion. But there are two particularly, disruptive militia groups operating, the one that we call Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and the one that we call the Al-Houthis. I mean, they both have other names in Arabic. But and they're, kind of engaged. I mean, they're fighting against each other. And the irony is, and I don't think either of them expresses it in quite this way, but the irony is that they're both probably more anti-Saudi than anything else. The Saudi role in Yemen, which is fairly mysterious but also very you know, obviously a lot of interference. And again, I think not just as a unitary actor, but sometimes various princes, I think, play off different factions in Yemen in his way of kind of engaging in internal palace politics within the kingdom, if that makes sense. But that kind of policy of king-making and of they do things like they'll let in a lot of migrants to work and then they'll expel them all, and they're building a wall between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, and they've just cut off aid, and they'll use aid as a kind of carrot and then withdraw it. And all of that has been, you know, deeply disruptive, and I don't think it's a coincidence that the two militias that are now fighting in Yemen, more or less somewhat against the Yemeni government, well, fair amount against the Yemeni government and against each other, but they're both of them very anti-Saudi. And, you know, Yemen is the most populous country in the Arabian Peninsula. It's the only republic, and it's a desperately poor place. So there's an expression in Yemen which is so far from heaven, so close to Saudi Arabia.
And the U.S. is continuing its drone policies and drone attacks in Yemen.
Yes, assiduously. And, you know, sometimes, occasionally, Saudi Arabia has participated in this, and a lot of them seem to be launched from a base, an unknown, almost certainly existing base inside of Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, American policy in Yemen is inextricably linked to the American partnership with Saudi Arabia. I've often said that Yemen, the U.S. does not have a Yemen policy. It has a Saudi policy, and Yemen is in Saudi backyard.
Toby, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think Sheila hits it. I mean, the United States continues to view, in spite of our sentimental rhetoric around issues like development and modernization and then sort of the need for social development and economic growth in a lot of these places, American policy at its finest grain, you know, level continues to view almost all problems as either political or geopolitical problems. And Yemen has no shortage of political issues, from the southern secessionist movement to the presence of al-Qaeda, this Houthi network in the north that may or may not be, you know, dangerous. But Yemen's, it seems, and Sheila may disagree, but it seems to me that, you know, the Yemen's most pressing issues are, and they're catastrophic, are socioeconomic and environmental. This is a place that's desperately poor, that's running out of, if not out of water, that has declining energy resources, that has experienced very little in the way of the kind of uplift that its neighbors might provide if aid dollars were going to meaningful ends. The United States compounds all of that and frankly worsens it by engaging in Yemen as though it is only a center of danger and crisis in the region, that the only reason we should engage there at all is to bomb it. And that exaggerates and intensifies not only the social catastrophe, but also the level of antipathy that exists towards the United States for not seeing these other core issues that are fundamental for millions of Yemenis who are adversely affected by all of this.
Well, we should do a show on Yemen because we could definitely talk about that for an hour. There's also the wall, the fence that Saudi Arabia is building between Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
Yep.
All right, so we'll definitely do a show on this because there's a lot to talk about on that issue. Today we are talking about Saudi Arabia and its relationship with countries like Yemen, the United States, the Middle East. What questions do you have in light of the death of King Abdullah, who recently passed away at the age of 90? President Obama and 26 U.S. current and former government officials flew to Saudi Arabia to meet newly crowned King Salman. President Obama cut short his trip to India. In India, he talked about human rights and women's rights. In Saudi Arabia, he was completely silent, and he's being criticized for that. So what questions do you have about Saudi Arabia? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Toby Jones is Associate Professor of Middle East History at Rutgers and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Sheila Carapico is Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond and author of Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. We have two questions about Israel. Jim writes, the Saudi relations with Israel are complex. Their peace plan on the table still calls for full normalization of relations with Israel, but Israel has consistently downplayed and dismissed this huge offer. Does Saudi Arabia get arms from Israel? Seems like the arms trade makes for contradictory bedfellows and led the king and other Arab leaders to throw the Palestinians under the bus. So let's take that one first. Toby or Sheila?
Go for it, Toby.
Toby?
Well, look, I mean, there are no public, I mean, there are very limited public, what we know, let me rephrase it, what we know about Saudi Arabia's relationship with Israel is unclear. There are likely intelligence and security connections. In fact, there has been evidence recently of Israeli military or arms firms operating in Riyadh, or at least their representatives being inside the kingdom. But what we do know is that that Israel and Saudi Arabia share perhaps a common sensibility about who they both think is the biggest threat to each of them in the region, and that's Iran. And they have been the most outspoken, particularly with regard to the United States, needing to act most forcefully on containing and confronting the Iranian threat. These are the two warmongers in the region that would like to see the U.S. use its resources to push back Iranian influence. And the Saudis are more than happy to sacrifice the Palestinian issue. And, of course, the Israelis are more than happy to have a reason to ignore it. And in this way, they work together, and they assert and exert a similar kind of influence over American policymaking, which paralyzes any kind of traction or forward movement on confronting and dealing with the Palestinian problem in its own terms.
And then we have another question from Dory. An aspect that has yet to be discussed is Saudi Arabia's security cooperation with Israel, especially its support of Israel's militant policy against Hamas in Gaza and their hand-in-glove pursuit of destabilizing Iran. Any comments on that?
Well, Sheila. I mean, just it's kind of follow-up of the previous question. I mean, they came in simultaneously, obviously. But it also relates, I think, I mean, the if you watch Saudi TV or listen to the radio, I mean, they're harsher on Hamas than they are on Israel by a fair amount, and I think that relates to their kind of dread of populist upheavals, of changes in the status quo. And so, as Toby hinted, I mean, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel are all fundamentally status quo powers in the region. They have a shared hostility towards Iran. They had a shared sense of panic when, particularly in Egypt, when the uprising began, of, you know, a wave of revolutions, you know, sweeping things aside. And so, although I personally cannot speak to the extent to which there is direct security cooperation, it's obvious that there are shared security concerns that would then therefore make the security cooperation logical.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We've got a web comment from Andrew who says, I can relate to the flavor of embarrassment Sheila referred to. It tends to arise when you get your passport stamped, like the embarrassment of a student whose father shows up drunk to a parent-teacher meeting. I was embarrassed when President George W. Bush's comments were reported in the very Western Hong Kong media when I was there years ago. Maybe you can claim you wouldn't be embarrassed, but you sure wouldn't be proud either. We have another web comment that says, what would a democratic Saudi Arabia look like? That might be another good question. Could the guests give us a sense of what might happen if the monarchs handed the keys over to their subjects?
Well, they're not likely to do that. I mean, the name of the country is the name of the ruling family. On the other hand, I mean, it's not entirely implausible, at least, again, in a kind of, you know, spinning a scenario sort of way, one could imagine the gradual introduction of, you know, something more resembling a constitutional monarchy. I mean, they've tried now, experimented a bit with elections at the municipal level, but, I mean, that's very limited. There are certainly ways that they could reduce, you know, sentences like flogging for blogging. Mm. I mean, it wouldn't be impossible for them to reduce some of the most egregious human rights abuses In fact, it might very well be in their interest to do so, and to introduce at least some, you know, kind of what, for lack of a better word, we might call, you know, liberal political reforms. And, you know, there's one line of thinking, I'm not sure it's mine, but, you know, that if they don't do so sooner or later, their own inertia will undermine the House of Saud.
The flogging of Raif Badawi has been postponed for the third week. He was sentenced to 1,000 lashes for blogging. I also wanted to talk more. We have just about 5 minutes left, but talking about what the people of Saudi Arabia are actually facing. So can you talk a little bit about that, Sheila, and what we really need to know? It's a country of 28 million. I understand that 20% of the population live in fairly desperate poverty, and a third of the population are migrant workers.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the population is all Saudis. There are a fair number of migrant workers, and I would also add somewhat parenthetically that the poverty level in Saudi Arabia in Yemen is considered to be a pretty decent standard of living. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Toby's probably better able than I am to really talk about something about public opinion in Saudi. Toby, you want to give that a shot?
Well, I do think, I mean, relative deprivation, of course, matters. Yemen, poverty in Yemen is much higher. I think those numbers are right. I think the total population in Saudi Arabia is probably closer to 36 million, with 7 to 8 being migrant workers who, of course, are desperately poor, and many of them are subjected to conditions that are virtual slavery. I mean, it's a wretched system in which they lose control of their passports, much like the rest of the Gulf, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait included. So there's a large percentage of the Saudi population that lives below the Saudi Arabia's own standards for the poverty line, whether it's 20 or 30%. It's very, very high, and the conditions are quite desperate. There are also communities, minority communities. There's a large Shia community in Saudi Arabia. There are others. And then, of course, there's half the population that is subjected to some form of gender apartheid. Saudi Arabia is an oppressive, brutal place. I mean, this is a country, according to some estimates, that has 30 to 40,000 people detained in prisons as political prisoners. It commonly uses torture. This is no way to maintain a stable political order. So on the previous question of democratic transitions, well, I don't know that democracy is the right way to think about all of this, but there are all kinds of internal pressures that the Saudis rule brutally because they worry about what the consequences of opening the system up might be. Now, our view of that might be, well, the Islamists or Al-Qaeda would come into control. I don't think we have enough evidence to say that's the case. Maybe a competition for political supremacy would look like Egypt after the fall of Mubarak, in which the Muslim Brotherhood is competing with other forces. But what I do imagine would happen is that the El Saud days would be numbered. And they understand this, and part of the reason they don't open up is because they don't rule justly. There is no equitable distribution of wealth. The system is corrupt and decrepit, and it relies on a commodity and the sale of oil, which it is increasingly clear cannot be relied upon to fetch the kind of price that's necessary to prop this system up. It is an embattled place where there are high levels of dissent and frustration, and for all kinds of reasons, whether because of politics or because of poverty or gendered opportunities or their absence. Saudi Arabia sits on a fault line, and it is a fault line. If Saudi Arabia ever had an Arab Spring moment, it would be both remarkable and it would transcend the region.
What are your thoughts about the people in Saudi Arabia who were emboldened by the Arab uprisings? Last year, we saw a few undercover reports and saw protesters really talking, saying that, you know, they didn't have a very clear set of demands, but they were saying, we want change. We want change. And over the past 3 years of protests, 20 men have been killed, hundreds more have been injured or jailed. So can you talk about that, Toby, and what people really face for, you know, getting together and expressing the fact that they want change?
Well, there's an old canard in social science, and particularly in economic literature, that says, and some political scientists are guilty of this too, that says oil-rich states are able to buy off their citizens through a system of co-option where they, you know, they have so much patronage available, they're able to buy political quietism. It has never been the case in Saudi Arabia where the citizens have gone quietly and sat docilely in the corners, not expecting more from their government. So there has been a history of dissent and challenges to political authority. This is not new. The Arab Spring certainly awakened echoes, and it reminded Saudis that they too could influence policy. It's interesting to gauge how the regime responded. The regime responded brutally in the region, in Bahrain, and of course supporting a military coup in Egypt, but also in cracking down severely at home. This is all to say these aren't new demands for the right to participate. They're old demands for the right to participate. And the regime is using an old set of instruments: oppression, the police state, torture, coercion, execution, all kinds of things to try to keep the quiet. They've never worked in the past, at least not for the long term, so we shouldn't have any expectation that they'll work into the future either.
Sheila, final thoughts on that one? About a minute left.
Yeah, just to add that, you know, and to that very, you know, well-informed analysis that Toby just gave, but, you know, two more things. First off, it's a very young population. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it is a relatively well-educated population. And well-educated youth are not likely to be indefinitely patient with the kinds of restrictions and brutality that are practiced by this gerontocracy.
Sheila Carapico is professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and author of Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice, and Representation. Sheila spent 10 years in the Arab region. Toby Jones is associate professor of Middle East History at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Sheila and Toby, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. Find resources at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Should body cameras be used in policing? On the next Your Call, we'll continue our series on police, community, race, and justice with a debate about body cameras. Proponents say they reduce excessive force, ensure accountability, and provide crucial evidence in the courtroom. Opponents say cameras do not tell the whole story, might reveal sensitive information, and are a major invasion of privacy. Do we really want to be recorded 24/7? How effective are body cameras, and where do you stand? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.